Welcome to today's episode of Tribe Talking by Tribe Global Ventures, the B2B VC. Today's episode deep dive segment looks at the issues around functional versus dysfunctional boards and discusses an article we've released with some ideas and processes to help solve issues such as poor communication between the board and management, lack of respect, destructive conflict, self-interested behaviours, and a lack of trust. We know fish rot from the head, so a well-functioning board is very important to the overall health of a company. Now, before we get to this deep dive topic, we recap on an earlier episode where we discussed our personal preference for co-founding teams. This was in response to some listener feedback we received that was very helpful to us in clarifying the context of our sharing these ideas and provide a bit more detail on our co-founder and sole founder position. We really appreciate all feedback and would love to hear from more of you. This discussion provided a great segue to reviewing the final episode of Founder, which featured the journey of Bright's sole founder, Catherine McConnell. We love this episode as it was a return to looking at more healthy entrepreneurship with an entrepreneur who's trying to do something noble in the pursuit of facilitating a faster uptake of renewable energy, but whilst fully integrated with her family and taking them on the journey. We also look at the nuance of Catherine being called a sole founder, but this partly being enabled by her husband stepping up and taking a more active role at home and with the family, reinforcing our view that significant others are often enabling co-founders of the business. We review some recent news topics, including continued reports of tech talent flooding into the market and the importance of having frameworks to help hire for cultural fit over experience. We also look at the challenges of startups doing deals with the Big Four accounting firms, following an example reported where PwC would retain non-dilutive equity and a retainer fee of $5 million for general promotion. And in a rather tenuous fashion, we managed to connect Taylor Swift's own journey to global stardom to this situation. We discussed the amazing rise of Nvidia in terms of earnings and share price growth on the back of the AI boom and what founders can take away in terms of building their own high-performing cultures. There are calls for more regulation of AI in Australia to ensure safe and responsible practices are developed. And finally, Bardi is back in the news, a company which raised $5 million in 2021 following reports of its continued financial struggles. One report implies that Blackbird stepping off the board darkens Blackbird's reputation as being founder-friendly, but we don't really see that being fair and share some thoughts on this implication in the context of our deep dive subject around functioning boards. As always, we'd love to hear from you and we'd really appreciate if you could leave a quick rating for this podcast.
Your haircut doesn't look that bad at all.
Don't you start.
I just gave him a few minutes.
I just said, I was being complimentary.
So I've at least gotten it to this point. This is what he had left me with, essentially. This overhanging set of male bangs. So I get home.
Are they called mangs?
Keep in mind that this is a $40 haircut with no vacuum at the end.
Oh, fuck it up, dude. You have no idea what we pay for haircuts. All right, shall we kick off?
Yeah.
Yep.
We seem so high energy today.
No, I'm feeling good.
Did you get any sleep, though, last night?
Fuck no. You've been away? No, I really maybe have had 2 hours.
So, oh, shit.
Yeah, I think I'm just in one of my insomnia cycles.
But... Let's see if we can solve it with today's content.
I'm feeling good.
Oh God, you're even like
moving
in your seat.
Do I not normally move?
No, no one's watching except actually a lot of people are watching on YouTube right now.
Right. And what filled your week to give you such immense energy and joy, Aaron?
No, if I actually looked at my week, that it's this gives me this is the highlight of my week.
Oh my God, you're talking. This is your highlight.
Yes. I feel sad for your week.
Yeah.
I love you guys.
Jack, what have you been up to?
Monday, I went to the Something X Festival with Aaron. And then yesterday, I flew to Adelaide. So I'm spending a bit of time. Yeah, it was good. It was good to catch up with Aaron and see a lot of the other people in the ecosystem. Good to go to an in-person event. I haven't been to one in a while.
Were there some good keynotes or discussions?
Yeah, there was some great discussions. And it was great to hear Jason from Cake. He presented at the FinTech, one of the FinTech speeches. So it's great to hear one of our portfolio companies.
Awesome. And what have you been up to, Lainey?
I've been in Canberra for the last 2 days, actually, with the Griffin Accelerator and Innovation ACT. So, yeah, it's been very full on, but good. There's lots happening in that territory.
Canberra can be exciting.
It can.
It can be. Canberra, the Canberra city. And you had 30 pitches or something, Lainey?
Yeah, so 17 pitches for the Griffin Accelerator, 13 pitches in Innovation ACT, which is student program. So 30 in 2 days, which was, it's a lot. But it's good. It's good. It shows that there's a lot happening and real engagement in the sector. So
there are a lot of events coming back. So to Jack's point, we had something X, something Q, something Tech, something Fest, something Digital, River Rival, but also UQ had their student innovation weekend bonfire, which was
the bonfire.
Yeah, yeah. Went and spoke there and that was quite good. They had startups from Sydney flying in for that.
Oh, wow.
And then Monday, spoke to the visiting UK delegation who were in town. And it's always interesting comparing UK founders who are scaling to Aussie founders we take the other way. I just notice UK founders tend to be a little bit older.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they wear suits.
They wear suits. It's yeah. Very English, isn't it?
Yeah. But then, yeah. But it's good to see a lot of activities happening again. Like a lot more events seem to be happening again.
We're starting to get into the festival season, I think. So
yeah.
Yeah, the calendar.
It's already September. By the time this podcast airs, it'll be September.
Insane.
Calendar is disappearing and we're all another year older. So that's
on the note.
But Don, yes, I can imagine you're grappling this week. But anyway, we should probably get into some news.
One of the interesting things from this week is we found out we have some listeners. So that's that's nice. So I'd like to thank
to the two of you who are listening. Big shout out.
I think one of their mums listened as well.
That's my mum. Constantly get reinforced how terrible we are at this.
I think he's doing a service to us because if we were to get too high and mighty, we could get into trouble. So she's just trying to keep us grounded.
That's her contribution to the Tribe Global VC team.
I guess one of the points of thought just came around one of our earlier episodes around co-founders versus sole founders. And that episode came from an article that we had put together, just sort of highlighting some personal preferences towards co-foundership versus sole foundership. And I shared a bit of a model around why that may be. I think it's important to note that all models are wrong. It's just that some are useful and you should never take anything as black or white as, and this is the way to go.
Yeah. But maybe Don, talk about the feedback. So it was solo founder who was, I guess the thought was, or the feedback was, it was depressing to hear investors talk about their preference for co-founders when I'm a solo founder, because does that mean I'm just getting immediately overlooked? I guess it was the
And was there no chance in success? So a couple of things to point out. Our biggest investment so far is a sole founder. One of our shareholders and our venture partner, Adrian DeMarco, who built a $5 billion ASX top 100 business, sole founder. Luke Anea, who we had on the podcast, sole founder. We're going to be having a session with Catherine from Bright, sole founder. So these patterns of highly successful sole foundership absolutely exist. And I think the point, though, is that whilst they exist, there's also a pattern of co-foundership. And if you've got the opportunity to be in a co-founding kind of relationship, there are some reasons why it can sometimes be a little easier. But what the episode and the article, I think, was trying to put forward was a bit of a nuance in that, yes, co-founders can divide up responsibilities and work together, but one of the big problems is the potential for destructive conflict.
Yeah.
And what I was trying to highlight was keep an eye out for this conflict, because not only is it going to happen, you've got to choose whether you're going to have constructive conflict or destructive conflict. And co-founder relationships can often be plagued by destructive conflict and they then dissolve and disappear.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think it was interesting pulling together some of that data for that episode, looking at Crunchbase and other sources that looked at solo founder success statistics. And absolutely, to the examples you gave, that there's a lot of case studies there. But you know, a lot of the work you do, Don, like talking about complementary teams, like how else do you build that complementary team around you if you are a solo founder? But I think the point was more around, yeah, conflict. Every co-founder relationship will naturally have conflict and the ability of a team to be able to navigate that. And I think that the counter to all of this is what I see some early stage founders take from this is they rush out to find a co-founder as if to tick that box, I now have a co-founder, mm-hmm. and end up kicking something off with someone that they barely know and not having had these discussions around mutual vision. What does success look like for us? Why are we doing this? Who are we? Understanding each other. I think it would be a mistake for someone to rush out and hear, wow, investors prefer co-founder relationships, therefore I need a co-founder and I will find one at any cost. So, yeah, I think it's quite nuanced, I think. But for us, it's a pattern. We're looking at patterns and to your point about the middle of the bell curve.
Yeah, but we look for patterns to try and mitigate risk, but also there's always outliers and our whole business depends on the outliers, right? So what we talk about is not absolutes. It's just observations and a bit of rationale as to why we think some of those patterns present, but always happy to hear feedback. It really makes us think and it's good for us to have some kind of issues that we can talk about because they're obviously resonating with people or causing things to knock around in people's brains. So we love that.
Just a quick pause from today's episode. You probably already know that Tribe Global Ventures is a venture capital firm that invests in Australian and New Zealand high-growth B2B-focused companies that have the US and or the UK on their expansion roadmaps. But we also run events, offsites, and missions that are sometimes open to founders and investors outside of our portfolio companies. Expanding overseas can seem daunting and risky, but not if you hang out with people that do this regularly. We run market entry missions to the US and the UK, and these missions help you gain a deeper understanding of market nuances, help find early customers, and connect you with people that can help with the early operational scale-up phase. You'll also be building lasting relationships with the other participants on each trip and learn from their knowledge and expertise. We also know that being a founder can be a lonely pursuit, and it's easier done when you have a broad tribe to lean on. So we run 1 to 3 day offsites where founders and investors come together to connect in building their companies. Different offsite programs focus on different things like personal performance, business performance, or a combination of both. Go to our website at tribeglobal.vc and subscribe to our tribe community to be kept up to date on all these future events. Okay, now back to today's episode.
I was just going to say on the topic of solo founders, I watched the final episode of the founder series, which had Catherine from Bright. She's a solo founder. Did you guys watch it?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Really enjoyed this one.
Nice to see a return, I guess, from a vibe perspective to the entrepreneur who's actually trying to build something of impact or even somewhat noble, which is the transition, supporting the transition to renewables. It was actually a lovely story to see and quite a contrast to the one we saw the week before with Finder and Fred and his co-founding team.
Yeah, it is interesting the four different personalities are saying that. I think they've done really well in terms of a series in capturing the different flavors of entrepreneurs. But yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. And for me, there was that intertwining thread of kids and parenting and managing that. And yeah, it struck a lot of chords for me.
I can't remember which episode it was, but we talked about entrepreneurship often being born in frustration and pain. And here I saw two frustrations and pain. One was on the climate aspect. What are we going to do as a species to transition some of this, but also an individual woman who's bringing up a family, got kids in a large organization that is constantly being left behind and having to try and choose between different outcomes on the personal and the business space. And you could tell through the story that when you're constantly left behind on promotions and opportunities and being looked over despite the skills and value that you're adding, that builds up inside. And here we saw it manifest in, I think, those two things coming together and saying, enough is enough. I can't live like this. And she took that frustration and pain and has done something great with it.
Yeah. She talked about, for those who haven't watched the episode yet, she talked about how she was constantly being passed over for promotions at Macquarie. And I think she acknowledged some of that was definitely due to the fact that she had time off to have and raise her children. But the implication was it wasn't entirely about that. And she was just could see if she stayed in that place that she was really not going to have the career that she wanted. And yet she had built such a innate, comprehensive understanding of the energy market through that at Macquarie. And she could see this opportunity that she thought, I'm just going to go do it myself because what's my alternative? Stay here and wilt on the vine in a big corporate. And so that was really the impetus of starting Bright. And I think there's probably a lot of women in the workforce who will resonate with that story, feeling like they're being left behind compared to their peers because perhaps they've had to step out of the workforce for a little while and feel like because you were unlike everyone else, perhaps you were being passed over for certain things. And so, yeah, I thought it was a really common story that doesn't get told a lot, particularly because we don't see very many female founders profiled in these types of things. So I felt that it was wonderful that they gave a platform to that particular challenge. And I think there was definitely an acknowledgement that the only reason that was made possible for her was because her husband was able to step back and be the primary caretaker for the kids.
And that's where I think there's a nuance in this co-founder, sole founder conversation. Catherine is described as the founder of Bright, but the Bright that exists today when I watch that episode isn't unless those co-founder relationship of the husband being able to step back a bit, take some of those aspects, those roles and responsibilities. If you were to look at your life as a whole needing certain structures and certain resourcing, that's what we saw there. And Catherine paid homage to it. I think when it's the other way around, it often doesn't get acknowledged.
Yeah, I think significant others are co-founders, essentially. Like maybe they don't necessarily have an operational role within the business, but they play as supportive a role as a co-founder, a tech formal co-founder does in helping the company be a success.
Yeah, I think if the partner isn't involved in the business or doesn't understand the business, it can be a real source of tension as well. And I think one of the things we experimented with at River City Labs were events where partners were encouraged to attend and even events purely for partners. It ended up almost group therapy. But yeah, it's not talked about enough and how much support and how much that actually matters to the success of the company.
And why do you think it was focused on in this episode with Catherine, whereas there was episode with Luke and episode with Fred, who were both single parents as well, but there was there's never any discussion about how important it is for male solo founders to get the support from their significant. It's not really profiled, but it is often brought into the narrative around female founders. Why do you think that is?
It's very true. Solo co-parent. I have two kids. I'm very fortunate that my ex and I have an extremely amicable relationship, and I do. We lean on each other to shuffle kids back and forth and break routines, and I'm very lucky to have that. But it's never been a question. Like I haven't been questioned on that. It's never been an issue.
The question you pose is why?
Yeah, the why is interesting.
Dog's not weighing in.
I am. My brain's a little slow.
No, it's not.
Sorry. The manifestation of the words that come out of my fast-paced brain can be a little bit slow. It's going off in 15 different directions at the moment. But in terms of why, things that come to the top of my head is the system that we are in at the moment is probably one, not probably, it is transitioning, but it is a patriarchal system that takes certain things for granted. And one of those things is the pattern that the man is out front a lot of the time doing a lot of the external working and the ladies at home doing the homemaking. And that is often not acknowledge the value that actually comes from that. It's just accepted as it is.
There's a long history of why those stereotypes and roles are quite ingrained. I guess it's just interesting to me that despite trying to get to some sort of level of equality in the workplace, and in particular, a lot of the ecosystem folk saying that they want to focus on getting more diversity, we still run these narratives like, oh, you're an outlier female founder. Oh, but here's how you make that work. You've got your husband who's decided to help you. And that same narrative is never it's never characterized that way for male solo founders. And we make a very deliberate decision to ask all of our guests when we have our founders about how they approached managing their family and their professional career, because one, we don't want to contribute to that narrative, but two, I think it's as important for the dads and the husbands out there to understand how others approach it as it is for the mums and the wives or significant others out there to understand how they manage that too. So I just thought that was an interesting editorial choice. It was lovely to see. This is not a reflection of Catherine. I mean, it was for her husband. It sounds like they've got a great relationship. How awesome that there's the whole family buy in to what they're building. And I mean, their kids.
Yeah, their kids.
See how they explain equity raising?
We should have them on just to explain it.
What little rock stars. I loved that because it shows what happens when you engage the whole family and you bring them along with you. But it is
on Twitter, Lainey, you were, and I don't understand why you just don't accept this as a good argument. It was pointed out to you that things are better for women and in 50 years, it'll probably have resolved itself. So what else do you want?
That's true. Don is referring to a little Twitter conversation that happened where, yes, that was pointed out to me. Things are better for you now. Just don't argue with the fact that nature gave men an advantage and just enjoy the civilization we created for you.
Yeah, I was going to say it was a little bit more man created civilization and the universe.
Anyway.
So you should be fortunate to be enjoying
your head in.
Any other comments on the Bright episode?
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating to hear that the Grok team had an internal focus on climate tech. And when you combine that with Mike's experience in the energy space, it's clear that they had a unique understanding to the problem and they were the natural or the ideal partner and investor for the company. And despite 30 other investors passing on this opportunity.
Yeah, you're totally right, Jack. And it's thank goodness Mike Cannon-Brookes and Grok are focused on this space. And there are more funds, professional investors that are focusing on climate tech, but they're still a ways behind. And it does require someone to have a unique perspective about a particular industry or a market to get these opportunities that look a bit weird and wacky to other people, but they can see the future and where it's heading and can see a path to why this would be potentially a very valuable company. So it is wonderful to see those types of investors, high net worth investors who have real conviction around a space and have the capital to support that conviction, back innovation like this.
And I think it's also a good lesson that often entrepreneurs will find capital raising a little easier if they're engaging with people that understand what it is that they're trying to solve.
Absolutely.
Now, I think those 30 prior meetings are important because you've got to hone your message and fine tune all of those items. But often I will see entrepreneurs out talking to people that they're just not founder investment fit, and it then frustrates the hell out of them. So,
yeah. And like one of our mentors says, this concept of natural owner, like who is the natural owner of that space or investment or whatever it is you're looking at. And yeah, that really resonated.
That's the final episode for the series. So I think, look, in my view, is that's been a wonderful contribution. I think they did a really good job of telling the stories and a diverse array of stories. When we had Luke on the podcast, he mentioned that they're going to attempt to do an international series. So yes, I'll be keen to see if that comes off.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah. So fingers crossed, we'll stay tuned.
If you're a B2B founder or investor, we have an upcoming offsite that may be of interest from the 10th of November to the 12th of November, set in the beautiful surroundings of northern New South Wales. Located 30 minutes from Gold Coast Airport and 1 hour and 45 minutes from Brisbane Airport, this offsite is limited to 20 participants to ensure maximum value and the building of new relationships. The 2 days will be spent unpacking strategies and frameworks to scale your company and unlocking inhibitors that may be occurring in terms of product market fit or customer segment focus. You'll get your marketing and value proposition message really clear to improve marketing conversions, and we'll be looking at how to plan and successfully expand into the US and UK markets. On the personal front, we'll look at several performance and mindset frameworks to help you ensure you can grow at the speed of your company and create new relationships to help drive accountability for the goals that you seek to achieve. This is also a perfect opportunity to bring one of your team to work through these topics together so you don't have to go back to the office and explain where you've landed. For more information and to apply, go to tribeglobal.vc/offsite. That's tribeglobal.vc/offsite to see if this is right for you.
There was also an article about tech talent sort of flooding the market. this week, which is reinforces a couple of the points I made in a blog I wrote a couple of weeks ago around why it's a good time to invest in venture capital. And one of the points I made was that with the various different layoffs that have happened over in the tech wreck, that this means that there's like a talent pool to drive the growth of those companies that raise money at the moment, and they're not rate limited by that. But I guess there was a comment around the salaries, therefore, coming down, particularly in tech roles. And I guess, is that because of the tech wreck? Were those salaries inflated because of the pandemic? Is it a combination of both? What are we seeing in the market at the moment, guys? What do you think?
Yeah, causality probably a factor of all of the above. But you know, these things, they're cycles. And it was fascinating during the boom when everyone was struggling to get talent, hearing the conversation. There's always that narrative of this time it's different. This is the new normal. It'll always be like this. But history rhymes. This will come back in a cycle. So I think it's really healthy in terms, and to your point, Lenny, with your blog, absolutely a good time to be investing. But yeah, causality, I do think if you look at everyone, even my barber, going back to Don's haircut, my barber is struggling to get barbers to work in his barbershop. Like the talent shortage, hence why my military haircut looks the same no matter what I ask for. Yeah, it will come back. But sorry, Don.
And one of the important things I think that I reflected on after we had Susanna George on is hiring talent is always a challenge, in that it's actually easier sometimes when there's a shortage because you're forced into some decisions, but then it's harder because if you've got the wrong person, you end up sticking with them longer because you know you can't find them. But then at the same time, the same polar opposites occur when it's easier because there's more candidates and you've got to be able to choose them. My advice always is have some kind of framework that ensures you are filtering through people, both in terms of style and personality, but also values. And Susanna made a really good point of how they look for humble and hungry and a few of those things that they pass people through so they can see whether they're going to be a cultural fit. And then experience and expertise comes after that, whereas often founders are putting experience and expertise first, but you end up with someone that's not a cultural fit, and then they cause a whole lot of problems. And what it then also means is another line that she used is you can't be in an environment where you're constantly trying to hire to save your life. You actually got to slow the whole thing down, because to work out whether they're humble and hungry and what their style is, yes, you can do some tests and surveys, time with them. You got to take them out for a meal. You've got to get the other members of your team to meet them. I always like it when people meet the other half to see what that energy dynamic is like. And so now that there are more people on the market, don't think that it's going to become any easier without some tools, some scaffold to support you.
And there was a quote from Richard White in there as well, who made a comment that they never leaned into the silliness of these epic salaries that were being paid. And so it obviously wasn't a necessary thing to do, because his entire business is predicated on sourcing good tech talent. And if he didn't have to resort to that, it's clear that other companies didn't have to either. And I guess, Don, what you're saying is if you take your time and you're really intentional about it, that isn't required. It's maybe just a bit of laziness. Or do we think it really just was, there was high demand, low supply, and for a period of time, there was just this bump, which we're probably not going to see again for a little while, if at all.
Just to touch on Richard's comments, how do you avoid leaning into the silliness? Is it by focusing on the underlying, like developing the underlying structure instead of fixating on talent? And there's a quote from Taleb, Nassim Taleb, which is something along the lines of, leave people alone under a good structure and they'll get things done. So I guess my question is, should founders focus on constructing the framework that will nurture A-grade talent instead of fixating on the acquisition of talent?
Yeah, and we'll do a little plug for another podcast that is on our channel that we did with the team at Functionally. And Functionally built a piece of software to help fast-growing businesses get their structures right. I think my view on the answer is that startups have to start in a crazy, nebulous space to get moving. But when you heard from Luke and Adrian and Susanna and even Kim, there was this transition point where they started working on the machine. And one part of the machine is the structure internally to get the best out of people rather than an environment where the founder is trying to drive it. And I'll put it in the show notes, but the podcast with Functionally is just some ideas on how to get that structure, that scaffolding, that environment. How do you get the right people in the right roles? How do you ensure that you don't have unnecessary conflict? So my view always is, because I managerial frameworks are my love language, do it early. But what do you guys think?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I have nothing totally else to add over that. And actually, Jack, I think you answered the question yourself. I think you're spot on. I think the difficulty is just startups are often running so fast that they feel they can't stop for the time and discipline required to put those structures in, but they must.
There's a line that I sometimes use with them. You guys never seem to have time to do it right, but you always seem to have time to do it again. What's the go?
Thanks, Dad.
And that's what, once you get them to reflect on that, how much time they actually do burn over the same issue because they're too busy to do the underlying foundational work. But often they have to go through that journey and feel that pain. So you can't start off in this perfect situation. You have to have gotten to a point where you just can't live like this anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a good lesson for startups to take out of that article. And actually, speaking of lessons for startups, last week Capital Brief launched, which is the challenger brand for tech and financial journalism in Australia. And
get on it.
Yeah, like I've subscribed and have been paying attention, and I do feel like they have a different approach, which is good to see. So longer form journalism, focus on telling a deeper narrative around the space. But there was an article around PwC, which obviously gets a lot of clicks at the moment over the last few months, but PwC and their unusual arrangement with a startup company, New Law, I think it was.
LawVoo.
Yep. Thank you, guys. Obviously, the caffeine hasn't kicked in this morning yet. And the arrangement was that PwC were going to provide consulting services to the startup for nothing, but with an agreement that they would get paid in the event of a liquidity event. But that the fees that they would be due would be something like $5 million retainer per year. And if they introduced investors to the company, that they would get something like a 6x revenue, or customers to the company, they would get 6x the revenue that they introduced as payment as well. So
sounds fair. Sounds reasonable.
Look, I don't want to bag big four consulting firms. I think they do some good, great work too, right? But it seems like an unusual arrangement for a small company, which is, I think that the concept that they might defer their fees until a liquidity event sounds amazing. Of course you would do that. Sounds if you don't exit or something goes awry that you're not burdened with these costs. But a $5 million retainer for a big four consulting firm per year for a startup is not a number I've ever seen before. I can't imagine there's a lot of startups who could afford something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know the article focused on PwC and that, but we see this true of corporates. Like the number of times I've seen different corporates promise potential client bases and introductions and revenue streams, and that promise of fee-free, but we'll clip the ticket on the other side or whatever structuring. And I think if you're an early stage founder and first-time founder, you see something like that as a means of getting customers, a low-risk means.
Maybe a credibility anchor as well. Yeah, if you absolutely can say, this big company, this big four company is working with us, that's somewhat of a validation.
Yeah. But I've never seen it work except for one example, and that's actually PwC in the UK had a program that founders would enter and they would essentially do matchmaking to match that company with a corporate, an enterprise client that had a significant issue. And that was actually a very successful program, but the individual inside PwC who was running that was essentially an entrepreneur who later took that program out of PwC. It's now called Swift Scale. It's still a very successful program. In fact, Alex Saintie, who runs it, is normally one of the speakers in our London mission each year. But it was the individual who was able to navigate the corporate structure and operate like an entrepreneur. But ultimately, he was frustrated by PwC, I guess, tainting of the model, and took it out and essentially now runs it as his own program.
We had a founder pitching and was all very excited about this very big corporate brand that was coming on, expecting that we would probably throw money at that situation. And we gave the advice that here's all the issues that we see occurring time and time again, and that we don't share those things to be too negative, other than it's another pattern that we've seen. And these large corporates, what are they often trying to do? They have themselves become inflexible, and they've stopped being able to do certain things internally themselves, and they're looking to buy youth. And the way they try and buy that youth and flexibility is by doing these kinds of deals. Now, the person doing the deal in the corporate often is genuine and wants to do it, but doesn't realize all the stuff in the corporate that then conspires against them as time goes on to not deliver the value that they thought they'd be able to deliver.
Yeah. And we just keep it, we see it play out so many times.
So I guess the kind of the takeaway for startups is just to be just wary of these types of arrangements. So it's not a reflection of PwC or any other consulting firm or any other corporate. It's just no such thing as a free lunch, and to just be very critical of the review of these arrangements that they enter into, and to get advice from trusted people around them about how that might be viewed by the market. Because I think sometimes startups can do what they think is the best thing for them at the time without really understanding the unintended consequences that might create. It might make it more difficult for them to raise money. It might make that exit actually very challenging. So
I think there were some nuances in this one, though, that the way I read into it is that PwC had very specific access to this client base that was actually quite large, hence the $5 million a year, because the analysis effectively showed that it could withstand that. And this may be a little bit weird for some listeners, but it's very rare that some part of Taylor Swift's journey doesn't translate into our world. So if you could just bear with me. Now, if you look at when Taylor was very young, she ended up having to do a deal that gave away pretty well all of her rights for future work to the record company. Now, what is a record company? A record company is effectively a producer that then has access to that end market.
Distribution arm, essentially.
Distribution. And so often founders in startups are similarly looking for that distribution arm, and they end up doing shitty deals that later on either cost them a hell of a lot of money to get out of, or they've got to start again. And that's exactly what happened. But also it's a lesson that sometimes founders don't know what they have. They don't know their genius and their ability, and they believe that they need to go off and do these kinds of deals. Whereas if you knuckle down is not the right word, but there are sometimes for the right founders with the right genius and the right talent and the right ability, there may be a path. Now, having said that, the problem with all of this is there's no parallel universe. Did someone like Taylor get the flywheel effect of global stardom out of that, and therefore the problem that she has now only could possibly have occurred because of that deal? Or was there a path that wasn't? It's the same with founders, right? And so it's hard to make that decision. But anyway, I just wanted to...
Yeah, we always like bringing it back to Taylor Swift. And I was trying to think which, because I've sent Don a couple of Taylor Swift podcasts.
I didn't know where it was going when you started that.
No, look, it's fat. There's a couple actually. And one is the Acquired podcast around... So we'll talk about Acquired in a second as well, the podcast, because it's excellent. It's usually, it picks a company or a thing. In this case, in the case I'm talking about, it was the business behind Taylor Swift, and pulls it apart in autopsy detail and talks through, explains for everyone how that business works and how that particular company was successful. So if you're a Taylor Swift fan and a business fan, I thoroughly recommend going and listening to that podcast. They're usually very long, but there was one I sent Don as well last week specifically around the details of the re-record and the shenanigans that happen in the background. And it's also equally interesting just from a business perspective.
All of these things are patterns, and they play out in different spaces, and they're not absolute. They're just interesting things to gauge against your own journey.
Yeah.
Listeners of this podcast will know we like to do shout outs to our portfolio because you could be their customers, and well, we're shameless pluggers. We're proud to be invested in Cake Equity, which is the go-to platform when you want to implement and manage an employee share or option scheme to attract and retain the best talent, as well as managing your cap table and investor updates if you're raising outside capital. It makes managing this all a breeze without the huge expense of accountants and lawyers, and unlocks the value of your equity to help you build the next unicorn.
One of the really interesting and frankly outstanding bits of news last week was the NVIDIA announcement of quarterly revenue and earnings. I don't know if anyone's been following this who's listening. It's a listed company. It makes chips. That's underselling it, really. It's a company that was started in the 90s originally to make GPU chips for gaming, really, was their kind of original use case. It was backed by Sequoia. I think Sequoia put $20 million into the company originally. And it's a fascinating story, and also one that was profiled by the Acquired podcast. It's a long podcast. It's 2 hours long, but it's a fascinating kind of a description of that whole journey of how this company came about and some of the business decisions that were made over the years. And I think one of the things that really differentiates this company is they have remained on the leading edge of processing and compute power and have aligned themselves very much with where is the industry going and how are we the chosen platform or technology that the leading edge, the bleeding edge of innovation is using. And so over the years, they followed that wave through, or led that wave is probably a better way to describe it. And that has most recently included how their chips are used to power a lot of AI-driven innovation. AI, particularly the training element of machine learning, requires a lot of compute power. There's very few chips that are able to support that, and NVIDIA are the kind of chosen providers, and over the years have acquired almost every other competitor except one that they couldn't because of anti-competitive regulation. But I think it's interesting because there's been a lot of talk in media, in our space, around artificial intelligence and machine learning. And is this a bubble? Is it hype? Is it real? And this company just posted, they just blew their forecasts out of the water. So for the June quarter, I think they had something like $11 billion of, no, let me get, see if I can get this number right. Yeah, $13.5 billion of revenue for the quarter, and had revised their forecast up for the next quarter to something like $16 billion net earnings. They've got margins of something like 70%. Their earnings were $6 billion for the quarter. This is astonishing. And
100% increase on same quarter last year.
Yeah. A company that is 30 years old?
Yes, I think that's one of the big things. Yeah. Our early stage businesses do this regularly, but you're going from what, $1 million to $2 million.
Yeah.
If you look at Adrian's episode as well, Tech One, 30 years, they've got this culture and climate that can constantly react to change, and they're able to get on the front foot of those trends. And so to Jack's point earlier, the goal of founders and CEOs should be to create that culture and climate that is high reactive to these trends rather than concentrating just on how great can I make the product.
And to start out doing one thing very well.
Yes.
And then build on that credibility and that kind of leadership position, if that's your competitive differentiator.
Absolutely. Like, I remember as a kid building gaming PCs, and NVIDIA, that was the card that you get. That was
remember Indooroopilly Shopping Town, they had this like computer store, and I still remember the box because their branding was really cool. And I must have been like 12 or 13 or something. And I just wanted whatever that was, I wanted it in my computer.
Yeah, that was absolutely the experience for me. And then you look at their shift through crypto and fundamentally driving the computational power of that, and now into AI. And in the last, what would it be, Jack? The last 3 weeks, we've seen, I think, 3 or 4 AI startups that are saying one of their rate limiters to growth right now is scaling of AI computational power in servers and data centers, and that's limited by access to chips.
Yeah.
So this demand is just increasing.
But these guys, NVIDIA, are controlling the industry in terms of how many chips they can pump out at any given time is actually what is determining the rate of that industry's growth, which is, we talked last week about monopolies, but it's really quite amazing. Yeah.
But it also highlights that sometimes founders, let's think of AI almost like a gold rush, they want to be on the end panning for gold, whereas selling the shovels and the pans for all of the gold miners is often the thing of most longevity.
Yeah, hardware gets poo-pooed a lot, right? As low margin, pretty unsexy business. And it can be, of course. But, you know, what this company has shown is, yeah, we're going to make some hardware, but then we're actually going to try and take over the entire stack. And we're going to do the software, the drivers, the platform, everything. And then they own it. And then they can deliver 70%+ gross margins, which are equivalent to what we see SaaS companies doing.
I just, there's no shortage of examples for start small, doing one thing well.
And build on
yes.
it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
As I said at the start of the podcast in Canberra, I saw 30 pitches over the last 2 days. 70% of them were anchored by AI machine learning.
Yeah.
So this is not a wave. This is a revolution. And this company has managed to put itself in the best possible position to take advantage of that revolution.
And
it's now worth over $1 trillion. It's one of the very few.
The trick for people like us, though, with all these new ideas coming through, is we've got the smaller emerging use case type AI. Hey, we're a tool that can go and do this. Then we've got the behemoths up the top with the more general approach. One of the insights during the week around some of the closed AI and building specific sort of use case kind of AI from a longevity point of view was the insight that was, I think, shared by you, Lainey, around the first source of a lot of the stuff AI is looking at is the documents. It's the data. It's the information. And all of that lives in places like Adobe, Microsoft, et cetera. And then those places have unbelievable chunks of capital plus the IT horsepower. Why are they not just going to come in and, as a vertical emerges as a specific use case, just wipe the floor?
Oh, I think they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's inevitable.
A little bit of a segue, because obviously AI, there's a lot we can talk about here. But just to validate that we do have listeners, I just got an SMS from Terry Woodcroft, who recently had her exit.
Yes.
Saying she and Bernie, who used to run iLab, are driving in their car listening to our previous episodes of the podcast. And we're just sharing how delighted they are to be listening to it.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you, Terry.
That's awesome. Real-time feedback.
Yes.
And does it also say, could Don please stop frustrating Elaine?
Listeners, that's a reference to someone else's feedback who said, quite enjoy the Tribe Talking one, but it sounds like Don frustrates Elaine a lot.
I'm probably glad that it shows. The worst thing in life would be getting no reaction. So I'll take frustration.
Yeah.
There was a time where I would have been very happy with no reaction. So anyway, yes, that's lovely to hear.
We've got six listeners now. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does actually, and I guess another bit that ties in is an article this week around AI regulation as well. So
yeah,
as we see a lot in technology, there's always the innovation or the revolution around that innovation and then a furious scurry behind it to try and regulate it. And as we know, governments don't move necessarily as quickly as technology does. So it might feel a bit like the horse has bolted. But guys, what do you think?
Yeah, I think what was interesting for me, because there are three or four articles around this, and normally government is so far behind in the process of catching up with regulating emerging technology. But there were some calls that maybe the government should actually take their time.
The Australian government, by the way,
the Australian
calling
government,
for how it can develop safe AI practices.
Yeah, so a bit of commentary around maybe they should take their time getting this right rather than reacting too quickly to regulating AI. I think for me,
never have time to do it right, but they always seem to have time to do it again.
Have a lot of time to do it right. But I think for me, that the two that really stood out for me was the commentary around AI generated content can't be eligible for copyright protection. Commentary that's been around for a while, but the fact that you cannot patent AI generated IP in Australia. And I think if we're looking at a world in which AI is embedded increasingly in everything, boy, it's a very grey line as to what constitutes AI generated. If we're using AI to augment human capability, is that considered AI generated or is it purely AI generated? I think it's a really murky water to navigate for regulators.
Yeah. And a big tech weighed in saying, we prefer a light touch, which is shocking.
Yes. Surprise, surprise.
There's a lot around this. So one is, yes, that is an interesting observation. And maybe we should get Rob McInnes on the podcast, who's an IP lawyer, not a patent attorney, but an IP lawyer who follows this stuff a lot. He can probably love to get him to weigh in on that specific point you made. But also just the data sets and information sets that artificial intelligence is being based on. We got a lot of artists, for example, who are screaming, saying that's completely unfair and a use of my own intellectual property, who is suing OpenAI and ChatGPT for using her comedy to as a data set. So that, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, right? There's a whole bunch of stuff that's gnarly that sits around this sector.
Yeah, I remember there was a panel of artists talking about using the future of the technology being to enable you to select your artist, replicate their vocals with lyrics specific for you. And basically we live in a world where music is tailored exactly to myself. And then how do those artists actually be rewarded for that? And who owns that intellectual property?
Yeah, and we've got strikes in the US at the moment, actors and writers strikes, because we're AI and using their likeness is a specific part of their kind of demands and negotiations. But we're also not seeing regulation apply equally everywhere. So when we were in the UK in June, there was a lot of Rishi Sunak was talking at London Tech Week and making a very big statement about how he wants the UK to be the center of AI research and innovation and development, and that they were deliberately applying a very low touch regulation to AI, which was in distinct contrast to the rest of Europe, which had just passed a whole bunch of AI regulatory frameworks because they were deeply concerned about the impact of AI and wanted to make sure it was being used safely and ethically. So we've got different territories trying to approach this in very different ways.
I remember meeting the mayor of San Francisco City once and asking about the role of government in supporting the tech sector. And his response was to get out of way as quickly as possible, and that less regulation enables more innovation, which I thought was interesting and resonates with that UK approach. I think in terms of attracting companies, like if you're an AI company and a government is making that stance, it is appealing to be based there, right?
Like absolutely.
So it's a smart strategic move to hoover up the AI talent. The question is, what are the adverse outcomes from that approach?
Yeah. I would just like some kind of switch that at some point there's no shortage of information for the AI to demonstrate that as a species, we don't actually deserve to be here. So if we could just protect ourselves from that, I would appreciate it.
Sure. Another thing that I read on the weekend in the Weekend Australian was that lovely long form article about Synchron and the brain interface device that is using AI and machine learning to help patients who are in locked-in syndrome or have motor neuron disease or ALS, who have lost the ability for their brain to communicate with their body. They've managed to devise this chip, which they now don't have to do brain surgery on. They can just insert
through the jugular, isn't it?
Yeah, through the jugular. Put it in the right spot, and then they in the right spot to detect brain waves, and then they use AI and machine learning to read and train the device on the brain waves that your own brain produces to try and code when you're thinking about something and trying to do something. They then convert that into computer interface that allows you to do that. So it's allowed people who were unable to communicate before to communicate just by thinking. It's astonishing. That is
I get a visceral feeling thinking about if I was in a locked in.
Me too. My worst nightmare.
It just.
I agree, but then I'm always reminded of not being like my mother or father in some ways. And my mum's reaction to online banking and not having a passbook anymore, I think there's a generational aspect curve to all these things in terms of adoption. And so while it freaks me out in some ways, I can absolutely see an inevitable future where we are augmented with computer chips that interface and allow us to communicate at the speed of thought and to exist in almost a purely digital consciousness, which is...
Which sounded like science fiction 5 years ago or 2 years ago. And it's not.
And being batshit crazy. But we've had some conversations a number of times on a broad concept of if you could actually feel how someone else was feeling at a certain point in time, humans would find it difficult to walk past a lot of the shit that we walk past. There are some interesting philosophical things that come out of a more interconnected environment.
I do want to challenge you on that one, though. Do you think that people walking past these things is because of a lack of awareness of what the others are feeling? I think there's still a subset of humans that, regardless of having complete understanding and transparency on someone else's emotions and thoughts, would still.
I'm in the middle of the bell curve, Aaron.
The other thing that I think is remarkable about that story is, number one, it's an Australian company I'm a medical device person and I'd never heard of it. So, and that's not saying I'm the highest bar. I'm just saying you would think if it was relatively mainstream,
Don't they know who you are?
No, it's just been doing these amazing things and operating on the radar, under the radar. It's the first company that was given permission by the FDA to undertake the first sort of safety and feasibility trial with a device like this. So it's beat Neuralink to the punch on that. It's just awesome to see Australian innovators just
absolutely
down doing these amazing things, which truly have an impact, right? And so, yes, regulation absolutely needed. And there is both a utopian and a dystopian future in AI, and we need to bias to one and not the other if we can. But my goodness, like I said before, it's not a wave, it's a revolution.
And it segues in a way, if we revisit Elon Musk owning the communication systems of battlefronts and everything else and monopolization of this technology. Imagine if this type of human computer interface technology was in the hands of one essential individual. It's a scary world.
Yeah.
If you were switched off from the grid of that.
Yeah. I listened to Kara Swisher's podcast interview with Ronan Farrow, who wrote that article last night on the plane, and it's pretty interesting. It's another podcast I recommend people get their ears around if they can. But after our podcast talking about that, there was another article about musing on whether Elon is a threat to our NBN or not. So it's in people's minds now, and understanding that owning these pieces of critical infrastructure and having them controlled by a private citizen has its challenges, and we should wake up to that and do something about it.
And I'd like to congratulate the AFR on a couple of weeks after it coming out, bringing that to people's attention.
Maybe they're a listener of the podcast, Don.
What, seven? Calm down.
Calm down.
Speaking of our industry publication of record, there was another article on Bardi.
Yeah, so I guess a bit more meat around the bones after an article that was written a couple of weeks ago where it talked about the Blackbird representative stepping down from the board, and that being an unusual thing, or they proffered that it might be signs of some sort of unrest. And then this article having a bit more information around it being in the eyes of the watchdog around, I guess I can't remember the term, but something about financial processes and payment of staff, that sort of thing. And
I think the article mentioned that the stepping down was after some disagreements around financial processes and some operational matters. And financial processes can be code word for a range of different things that investors get nervous at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess we don't really want to comment on that. It's impossible to provide any coherent comment given the limited information. And we also know we don't want to make anything worse for the company. We don't want to speculate with limited information. We know what it's like to be in this position. And also, they're a private company and the public doesn't necessarily deserve to know all their information about what they're doing. So I always just trust that the regulators and other people who will do their due diligence to get to the bottom of anything. And if it's fine.
The article was seeking to try and do was blacken Blackbird.
Yeah, being a not founder-friendly investor because they have stepped down from the board. And I just don't think that's a fair statement at all. Like, you can be completely supportive in many ways. And in fact, most investors do their support for companies not sitting on the board. So I think that's a very unfair statement. And I've co-invested with Blackbird a number of times, and I've always found them to be very founder and investor friendly, actually, both in good times and bad times. So I've never seen any sort of unfriendly behavior. And I just don't think stepping down from the board is somehow being founder unfriendly.
Yeah. So stepping down off a board isn't the metric of how much an investor is supporting, because there can be lots of reasons for stepping down off a board and lots of reasons for even joining a board. And like in our case, we have influence without actually having a board role.
And boards play a different role to investors. Like they often include investors, but the role that individuals play when they're on a board is to do what's in the best interest of all shareholders, right? So they wear different hats. It's complicated. But what is important is that a company does have access to a board that is functional, or else potentially things, not great things can happen.
Yeah. We've all seen all different iterations of boards, some highly effective, many dysfunctional.
They bulk humans. So there's a high chance of dysfunction.
Yeah. But there is a blog post going up on our site at the moment, Don, that you wrote around boards.
Yeah, I think Laney's point, the boards are a collection of humans, and humans are most functional operating together when they got some rails to run on. And what the article that I've put forward is just trying to give some ideas on some frameworks and some tools to provide rails to run on if a board isn't being as functional as it is. And so there's sort of two articles. There's the first article we put up a little while ago, which is just some of the common dysfunctions around boards. And this goes more into, I guess, the prescription or a suggestion on how to solve it. But yeah, Laney and I had a prior convo just trying to rattle off all the functioning boards, and it was a little bit short. Not, I think it's fair to say that this is often in more larger organizations, larger companies, where the board has started to get larger because of an arbitrary size goal, or where every shareholder has decided that they want representation. And so what then happens is you end up with boards that aren't being constructed because of key expertise or relationships or domain expertise to help the company. They're being constructed on the basis of self-interest protection and watching out. And I think, Laney, you've had a lot of experience in a range of different examples.
Yeah, and I guess that's it's a key piece where we see this lack of alignment or alignment fall apart, is because you've got a lot of people that are not in those seats because they can be useful for the company. They're in those seats because they have a particular agenda. And that, I think, can put a significant impost on management teams, because they spend a lot of time managing those different agendas or those different goals, instead of having a kind of a harmonious group who understand that their role actually is to do what's in the best interest of the whole shareholder group as a collective, as opposed to pushing their own agenda. And I think that can cause some real dysfunction, which, when things are going really well for a company, is often masked and can be managed and overlooked. But when things go not so well, which inevitably happens for most companies, those dysfunctions can really blow up into big issues, which can cause harm to the company and can be its undoing as well. And so trying to recognize that, trying to make sure that boards are really functioning in a way that is constructive and the communication levels are appropriate, I think is a big challenge for a lot of boards. There's a lot of kind of challenge in how people will confront some of that dysfunction, and it just festers.
Yeah. And the poor CEO ends up in this, the linchpin between two triangles. There's a triangle on the bottom of the organization that's shaped the normal way, and then they're in the middle, and then the triangle of the board facing the other way, and they're getting these pressures where they're running around. And it segues to a podcast we'll be releasing with one of our portfolio companies, with Claudia and Russell from Apply ID, and they mention how important it is to have that strong chairman role. Yep. And the role that the chair should be providing between management, the board members, shareholders, to try and provide a bit of a filter. Yeah. And so what this article tries to put forward is that once you're on a board, now you could be the CEO, you could be the chair, you could be one of the other board members, and you start experiencing some very common things around lack of communication, lack of trust, self-interest coming to the top. That's the point where if you don't pause and start to put some process in place, some rails to run on, things tend to get worse. And what often happens is the saying, the fish rots from the head. If you start to get really dysfunctional at that board level, that ultimately starts to cascade itself into the organization. So what I've tried to do with the article is just put together some simple sort of ideas. The first step, a bit like the medical analogy, is no good doctor ever gives you a prescription or a thing without diagnosing it first. So you've got to have a process where you can get all your issues on the table. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to understand the interconnectedness of different symptoms. And so if you can get all of the issues the board's having, then the next step before trying to jump in and solve is, hang on a minute, let's just try and see what's causing what. And in the article we use with companies,
It's a sort of a chain of causality approach that looks at our culture and climate and structure and managerial approach all combines to infect the operating system of the place. And then all of those things combine to create these manifestations, which are people behavior, performance issues, all of those things. And what you've got to be able to do is take this nebulous series of all of these issues and just put it down in a method that people can be staring at a situation of issues rather than staring at each other.
I think what your methodology does, Don, as well, is because it breaks it down into sort of problem, symptom, manifestation, you can, because I think a challenge companies, whether they're management teams or boards have, is they see all these things that they've done this brain dump of all the things that are wrong, and they're like 100 things. And they're like, I can't fix 100 things at the same time. It's too overwhelming. But when you go through that process, actually what you work out is 90 something of them are manifestations, and actually the problems, there's two or three. And so you just focus on fixing those problems and everything else should knock on and sort itself out, which I think makes it manageable.
The additional health analogy is if you turn up to the gym at day one to try and start lifting the 500 kilo weight, you're either going to give up or you're going to hurt yourself. And whether it's boards or whether it's companies, it doesn't really matter. The 500 kilo weights are often culture and climate and conflict and trust and respect and interpersonal relationships. And it makes sense. If I can solve those issues, everything else goes away. But those issues are really complex, big and heavy. The approach is start in the middle of the more operational process structure items. And if you do those well, and you do those things in a manner that build trust, that build respect, that build healthy communication, what you will find is that the culture and people's behavior change. And I'll link into it. In a previous life, I did some stuff with Jack Cowan of Hungry Jack's and Domino's. And there's a 5-minute video of him talking about one of the sessions with one of his teams where he was disappointed not to get to the record of, he only got to 240 problems inside one of his businesses, and he was pissed to know that the record is like 300. But actually, when you break it down, there were like 10 things that, if handled well, will solve all of those other things. But if you don't have a mechanism to try and identify that. And so at the board level, we're just using the same approach, really. It's just that the board has their own challenges, just like the operations have their challenges. And then you just need a process to prioritize which of those two or three or five or six. And I put some ideas in that article. And then the final bit is install this as a habit, install this as just the way we do things around here, where part of the board meeting is we're adding issues. Is this a cause thing? Is this a symptom thing? Is this like the outcome of all of these? Process where people can add their shit. Then let's prioritize it. Now, do we have the capability and capacity? Who's going to take accountability for it? How are we going to work on it? You're effectively creating an air traffic control system that before these operating problems manifest into a big screw up, you've got this environment that's catching them, and suddenly problems become a good thing because, oh, we've got an environment to bring them up. We don't have to do the back channeling outside of the board meeting. We don't have to have these little clicks start to flow.
Factions.
And ultimately, pardon?
Factions.
Yeah, the factions forming. And so anyway, there's just some ideas in there that if you're a founder, an investor, or even just on a board and it's you're not getting the best out of it, maybe there's something in there that can help.
And by the way, you don't need to just do this for like when things are going terribly. We do this.
The best time.
No.
We do this. Yeah. Tribe does this.
Yeah.
Don forces us to sit down and list all the things we dislike or problems that we see and in how things are going, and then we work out which is the problem and which is the symptom, and then we try and solve it.
Look, you're dead right. I guess I am so default to explaining when you're feeling these problems. Humans have this tendency to wait until the burning platform and things that are turning to shit. If you do this when things are good, what you find is you don't end up with the challenges that manifest into problems. And people like Jack Cowan and other really great founders and owners, this is what they do, and they go towards it and they say, actually, problems are a really good thing because if I solve it faster than my competitors, I'm going to win.
Yep.
It's a beautiful framework, and having it as a practice. And Don, you introduced it to me a while back, and using it even for personal life and other things, it's a great
tool. Well, after this call, I'm going to get my chain of causality out and put haircut. And
yeah, highly recommend that particular post to listeners. It's just such a beautifully simple framework. That's the power of it. It's just a really incredible framework to adopt.
And the inspiration always ensure where you've stolen all intellectual property from.
The circle of theft.
The circle of theft. There's a lot of stuff by Ishak Adesis of the Adesis Institute that's out there on these kinds of topics.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, Don. All right, that's the weekly news wrap up. There was, again, a lot. Never ceases to stop, does it?
That's awesome.
Never ceases to stop. That makes no sense.
Don't come here trying to get it all semantically right.
Yeah. So what are we excited about this week?
Oh, ask someone else first. I need to think.
So I'm hoping, and I'm just going to put it out there because that's the way we are, transparent, and even if it means we're going to fall on our face, I'm hoping we hear about the Queensland Venture Capital Development Fund and whether we get through to the next round. That's what I'm really excited about.
Yes.
I hope we do, is in case you're wondering.
Yeah. I hope we get a stern rejection.
But I'm thinking that's got to be anytime soon. So I'm hoping we hear about that.
Yeah,
shit, but it's scheduled for sometime soon. So hopefully, fingers crossed. I do have a big, key, pivotal personal life moment coming up next week that I'd rather not broadcast, but let's see how I am next week.
We're sending good vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my big focus and something that I am weirdly excited about.
Awesome. Jack?
Yep.
I'm looking forward to catching up with some family tonight, going around to my grandparents for dinner. So good to see them.
Nice. That's because you're back in Radley.
Yep. Yeah, I got back yesterday.
Don.
So my father's been away for a couple of months on a caravanning trip with his very good mate, and he's back. So for Father's Day, my brother and I and dad and the elder of our kids, the four-year-old, the three-year-old and the two-year-old, are hitting the bay in the boat.
Nice. And
I am very excited for that.
Lovely.
And Lainey? Well,
that sounds beautiful. Awesome. Listeners, thanks for tuning in again. Please, as we started out the episode, we're keen to get feedback. If you have thoughts or feelings about anything that we talked about today, please share with us. We want to hear it, good, bad, and ugly. But until next week, have a good week.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone.
See you next week.
Thanks for joining us on this week's episode. If you're still here, we'd love you to leave a rating. And don't forget, you can check out all of our episodes on YouTube. Thanks for spending your time with us. See you next episode.